We're doing Parshat Chukas, Parshat Chukat, and as usual, we'll do a quick overview of the Parsha and then start going over it with more depth. Our Parsha begins by declaring the statute of the Torah is the laws of the red cow. You take a cow that's whole, that has no blemishes, and the Kohen takes it out of the camp, he slaughters it, and he sprinkles from its blood 7 times in the direction of the temple or the Ohel Moed. They burn it, and then they take a special type of wood and special type of grass and red thread and throw it into the fire. And then the Kohen has to wash himself, and then the ashes are used to purify people who became defiled. How do you purify a person? If a person became defiled by a dead body, so then he gets sprinkled on from these ashes on the 3rd day and on the 7th day. And then the Torah tells us, what is this concept of defilement, spiritual impurity, what we call tumah? If someone dies in a tent or under any overhang, any covering, anyone that comes in into that tent with him becomes tameh, becomes spiritually defiled for 7 days. The same is true for any open vessel that's in the tent. And the same is true if you have any metal instrument in the tent, that also becomes tameh as the dead person himself. And how do you become tahor? On the 3rd and 7th day, you sprinkle, and a person becomes tahor. And that's the end of the Parsha of Parah Aduma. Then we have the story that Miriam passes away, and we lack water, and God tells Moshe to gather the people and speak to the rock, and then it will give forth water. For whatever reason, Moshe and Aaron hit the rock, and that is their fatal sin in more ways than one. And God says that for that they will be punished, that they will not enter the land of Israel, they will pass away in the desert. And we're up to Revi. We're holding by Edomite territory, and we ask for permission to pass through the land, and they refuse. We ask for some kind of agreement to let us pass through into Israel, and Edom refuses and goes out with the sword and sets up his soldiers to ensure that we don't come and try to take a shortcut through their land. We come to Hor Ahar, and God says it's time for Aaron to pass away. Aaron passes away, and Am Yisrael weeps his passing for 30 days, and we're attacked. We're attacked by the Kanani on the surface, and they come and they grab one maid. And we take a vow that if we succeed in capturing back that maid, we'll give all the loot over to God. And we succeed, and we destroy them and their camps, and everything's dedicated to God. We start traveling, and it's a long journey to go around Edomite territory, and the people get restless. So they start talking badly about God and about Moshe. What'd you bring us out of Egypt for? What'd you bring us to this desert? We're all out of bread and water, and we're sick and tired of this man bread. And God sends different types of snakes that bite the people, and people drop dead like flies. So the nation realizes they've sinned. They come to Moshe and they say, "We've sinned. Please pray that these snakes should leave." And Moshe prays. And God tells Moshe, "Make yourself a copper serpent, put it on top of a post, and anyone that gets bitten will look up at that and get cured." And we're up to Shishi. We travel, and we have the song that Israel sings about how they have water as they're traveling. We come to Sichon and Og, and again they attack us, and we conquer the lands of Sichon and Og. Og is the king of Bashan, and that's all the territory that's on the eastern side of the Jordan. Sichon and Og attack us, we win the war, and we capture all that territory on the eastern side of the Jordan. And at the end of the parasha, we reach Arvos Moav, which is our final resting point. We're going to stay here till the end of the Torah. We're camped on the eastern side of the Jordan, and we're ready to enter the land of Israel. So from here till the end of the Torah, this is where we're going to be at Arvos Moav. And that's our parsha in a nutshell. Now, after that 4-minute summary, let's go back and review our parsha with more depth. He was a famous doctor, and everyone knew that whatever he said was brilliant. Where no one else could figure out a solution, he did. And then one day, Chaim came in to him. And Chaim had heard all about him. And Chaim himself had experiences with his family where they had illnesses that no one could cure. And they came to this doctor, and like a magician, he cured them. And everyone always spoke about how the nation and the people of the world were lucky to have this doctor still with them. And he came before the old man, and the old man checked him, and he told him his ailments and his problems. And the old man said to him, "Listen, What's your name? He says, Chaim. He says, Chaim, I'm going to tell you the cure. What you have to do is every morning, before you brush your teeth, when you get out of bed, stand on your head and put your hand on your nose and do this. After you do that, you can continue with your day, and you'll see that after 2 weeks, you'll be cured. So Chaim is standing there looking at him incredulously and wondering, am I crazy or is he? And then Chaim says to himself, well, wait a second. It really seems silly to do that every morning. But he hasn't gained his reputation for nothing. All over the world, they talk about him. Everyone knows that his cures work. So what do you think Chaim does? He says, well, I don't get it, but that's why he's the doctor and I'm not. And he goes home and he does that for 2 weeks. The Ramban says, what? This is a mashal. That the Ramban says that that's the idea that the Torah tells us in Devarim. The Torah says the nations look at our Torah, and when they look at our Torah, they say, wow, that's a brilliant Torah. They have mitzvos that no one understands, like Parah Aduma. So the Ramban says, gee, if you wanted to tell me it was a brilliant Torah, because it says don't kill, honor your parents, I can understand. You tell me it's a brilliant Torah because it has mitzvahs that you don't understand. What's so brilliant about that? So the Ramban says it's just like the doctor. After the Torah has proven itself that the Torah is the best way of life, and the nations look at the Jewish people and they say, look at them. Look at what a good life they have. Look at how they've lasted throughout the generations in spite of all the persecution. Look at where they're holding in life. So then you look at it and you say, wow, that's brilliant. And then when you come to a mitzvah that you can't figure out, well, what's the idea behind this? How does this work? Then you say it's like when I go to an expert doctor. You say, well, this system has proven itself. So if there are going to be mitzvahs that are chukim, that are statutes that we don't understand, then the nations say, you see how brilliant it is? There are things that are way beyond human logic. I can't figure out how it works, Chaim says, but that's why I'm not the doctor. That's what the nations say. Look at all the mitzvahs we could understand. Look at the beautiful balance of the Torah. Look at the beautiful life the Torah gives them. So there are things we don't understand. That's only a sign of how great the Torah is and how distant we are from understanding it. That's what the Ramban says. The Torah says, that's your wisdom in the eyes of the nations. If the Torah were only about mitzvahs that we could figure out, well then that's no chokhmah. Great, so I could write a Torah too. The greatness of the Torah is that it goes beyond our logic. God goes and offers the Torah to every nation on the planet. And every nation asks God, well, what does it say? So at first glance, that seems to be a very logical question. You want to give me a way of life? I want to understand. What kind of way of life are you going to give me? But no, not when you're talking to God. When you're talking to God and you say, well, what do you want from me? Then what you're saying is, God, I'm going to do what I think is right. Well, then in that case, you're never going to be godly. You're limiting God to your own understanding. The key to being godly is being willing to do what I don't understand. If I'm going to limit things to what I do understand, then it's my religion. It's not God's religion. When God comes to the Jewish people say, we'll do whatever you say, God. You're telling us how we should live life. Of course we'll do it. V'nishma, we'd also like to understand. But our actions are not contingent on our understanding. Once we validated that this is God's way of life, so then I don't have to understand in order to do it. Our parsha begins with the most famous chok, the most famous statute. The statute of all statutes. God tells us to take a red cow. Why does it have to be red? Why does it have to be a cow? Take it out of the temple and slaughter it. Since when do we take animals out of the temple? That certainly seems to be the way of the satanic tribes. They take animals out of the temple. They take animals out into the wilderness. And the same holds true with the story of Yom Kippur, where God says, take an animal out into the wilderness and throw him off a cliff. So when you have these two mitzvos, the nations look at these two mitzvos and they say to us, you see, you guys are just like us. You're pagans too. You take a red cow, so we take our red or black animal. You see, you're like us. You see, you're superstitious. You see, you serve the Satan and everything else. So we say no. We're not doing that. We're not serving Satan. So they say, but it's all happening outside the temple. What do you mean you're not serving Satan? If you were serving God, how come it's outside the temple? So we say, well, God said so. So they say, well, God has a temple. Why would he tell you to do this outside the temple? Now there's an answer to that question. But we also have to know that it's very legitimate to say, I don't understand God. And I do what he says, even though I don't understand him. This is a statute. This is what God told me to do. I didn't decide this. He did. So this is just going to have to be the way it is. So this is the statute of the Torah. We take a red cow and we check it. We ensure that there are no blemishes. We ensure that it doesn't have white hairs or black hairs. If you have two hairs coming out of the same hole, you know, every hair has a little pore, a little hole that it comes out of. So if you have two hairs coming out of the same place and they're both black or white, so that disqualifies the cow. So you can imagine they look this cow over. And it has to be a cow that never carried a load on it. If you put a blanket over it to protect it from flies, that's okay. But it can't carry a load. There's a discussion whether it could mate, because then the male is climbing on top of it. And we take that cow once it's 3 years old, and we slaughter it outside the temple. And that's this happened 9 times in Jewish history. That's what the Mishnah says. And And then after they'd slaughter it, so then there was the whole procession we described earlier. Now the ashes of this cow would be the purifier for the heaviest type of defilement, tumas meis, right? A dead body, a human dead body, is the most defiled thing we have in this world, the human dead body, and later on maybe we'll discuss why that's so philosophically. So imagine if the Parah Aduma were done improperly. Imagine if they took a red lobster instead of a red cow. Okay, so then it doesn't work, right? And then everyone that's going to use those ashes to become purified is not really purified, so you got a big problem on your hands. So the rabbis, knowing this, the rabbis used this as halachic blackmail. How so? We had a group in our midst that was called the Sadducees. And what the Sadducees did was they'd sit on the sidelines and mock our traditions. Most of what they did was rhetoric. Sometimes they actually performed based on their rhetoric, and sometimes they actually tried to destroy our tradition or to cause us to err. And they were troublemakers. So in the temple, they tried to get their priest to be the high priest. They were Jews. They were Jews who just refused tradition. They were Jews who were disciples of the Tana named Tzadok and Baitus, who were disciples of Antigone, the leader of the city of Socho. And when Antigonus ish Socho told them that you shouldn't serve God for the sake of reward, they said, well, then I guess there is no reward. Well, if there is no reward, so let's enjoy this planet. You know, you had, at that time, the Greeks and the Romans developed different philosophies. You had those who said, don't enjoy the world at all, and then you had those who said, enjoy everything, because what's left after you die? So the Sadducees adopted that philosophy. They said, if our Rebbe said, don't do things for the sake of reward, obviously there is no reward. So they started enjoying life to the fullest. They'd buy themselves expensive goblets, they'd be drinking wine, they'd be doing whatever they could to enjoy life. One of the ways they could really enjoy life is by nixing all of the rabbinic institutions. You know, the rabbis say, Mukta, I don't want to do Mukta, I want to carry myself when I'm Shabbos. The rabbis say that you have to daven 3 times a day. I don't want to daven 3 times a day. I'd rather sleep late. The rabbis say you got to daven Shacharis by 4 hours into the day. I want to daven Shacharis when I get up. I'm going to sleep till 12. So what they did was, they said, we don't believe the rabbis. But really they did. That's what I said. Much of what they did was rhetoric. Because their goal was to enjoy life to the fullest, so the best way they could do that was by nixing the rabbis. And that's what we discussed in last week's parasha, that every generation had their korach, their movement that refused to accept the tradition. Basically all had the same motives. They just wanted to live a more comfortable life and still hold on to the name of being Jews. So the Sadducees were troublemakers in our history. They tried to mislead the courts about when the new moon was seen. They'd send false witnesses to mislead the courts. They tried to confuse the people out in Babylon as to when the new moon was seen. They used to lift torches as a sign that the new moon, that the new month was inaugurated, that the courts got witnesses. So they'd set up people to trick the people out in Chutzlarts, lifting their own torches. And They tried to get their priest as the high priest so that they could do the procession of Yom Kippur according to the way they thought the verses meant and go against our tradition. So what did the rabbis do? The rabbis had to fight back. So they did many different things, lehotzi miliban shel tzdukin, to try and convince them. One of the things the rabbis did was when it came to the red heifer, when it came to the red cow, so the Sadducees held that whoever deals with the red cow had to be completely pure. Because if he wasn't completely pure, then that would disqualify all the ashes. We have a tradition based on the verses that he does not have to be completely pure. There are some types of defilement that require a person going to mikveh. And after he goes to mikveh, you have to wait till nightfall till he's completely pure. Our tradition says that type of person can do the red heifer. They claimed, no, he's not completely pure. So what did the rabbis do? They brought a little vermin, one of the eight shrutzim, one of the eight creepy crawly creatures that defile a person when he comes in contact with them. And anyone who had anything to do with the Parah Aduma would first touch that vermin. Now they're tummy. Then they'd go to mikveh. Now they're half pure, right? According to the Sadducees, they're disqualified from doing the red heifer. According to our tradition, they're qualified. Anyone who dealt with the red heifer would touch that and then go to the mikveh. Now you understand that if you're going to ensure that everyone's just a little bit tummy, everyone who's dealing with the red heifer, so then people are going to start treating it very, very lightly. You know, so the rabbis, in order to counteract that, the rabbis made a whole series of institutions of chumras like you never had before and you don't have in all of the Torah. They set up stringencies that don't exist in any other realm of Torah so as to balance that. So that people would realize this is very serious business, the Parah Aduma. On the one hand, we're doing this trick to force the Sadducees' hands, because according to them, they have no red heifer. According to the way they interpret the verses, they have no way of becoming pure. They can never enter the temple. They're stuck. Either accept our tradition or goodbye, that's it. You can't enter the temple. You're defiled. The Sadducees were this cult that wouldn't accept our tradition. The disciples of Tzadok, those who said, we just want to enjoy the world today, we don't accept the rabbi's tradition. Tzadok was the leader of all this. Tzadok was the originator, Tzadok and Baitus.
So
they originated this movement.
And do we hold by them in any way, or do we reject them everywhere as the individuals?
No, we don't hold by them. They're on some level apostates. Yeah. They're Jews, but they're Jews who are like Korach. They're Jews like the Reform movement. Those that were born Jewish are still Jewish, but they're not living a lifestyle that's in accord with halacha. You can't eat their food because you don't know what's kosher. You don't know because they don't accept tradition, so that they could invent whatever they want. If you're not traditional, so then I can't know what you're doing. What?
Kind of the conservative now. They do make their own laws up. They do what they want.
Right. That's what we discussed last week.
That seem like they're smarter.
It's Korach of now.
Right. Well, that's what we said last week. Every generation has their Korach. People who don't accept tradition. I think that the conservative and the reform movement, you have to discern between the leaders and the followers. Meaning, the leaders are a lot of them are really problematic people. And
the followers
are right. Are Tinok Shenishba, that they don't know anything. They don't know.
Yeah.
There's a concept in Talmud, Tinok Shenishba leben Anochim, that sometimes you can have a baby that Gentiles capture and they raise him. So he grows up and they tell him you're Jewish, but he doesn't know what it means. So can you blame him for not keeping mitzvahs? You don't hold it against him. We say, poor thing, he was captured. So the second and third and fourth and fifth generation and all the followers of these movements, they don't know. They have no idea what's right or wrong. We don't hold it against them.
Now we're getting in trouble. Now it's after hearing this year, we get a little bit more of a dust.
Okay. So what are some of the stringencies they did? Some of the fantastic stringencies. The kohen who would deal with the Parah Aduma would leave his house for 7 days. He would leave his wife for 7 days. They'd have him in a special room that the vessels were only made of stone because stone vessels cannot become tameh. The other Kohanim wouldn't touch him. They'd sprinkle from the ashes of the Parah Aduma on him all 7 days to ensure maybe one time he became tameh and he doesn't remember. Come on, he's doing service in the temple all year long. You're not worried about that. Now suddenly we are. It's an extra stringency. They had special courtyards in Jerusalem that were built on a solid stone shelf with a gap underneath so that no tumah could come up, meaning it's solid stone, you know no one's buried there. And then there's a gap underneath because we say tumah smeis shoots up to the next gap. Meaning if someone's buried right here, the tumah shoots up till the ceiling. It stops after a gap. So they wanted to ensure maybe there's someone buried down there. We're not worried about that the rest of the year, but for this is a special stringency. What do? They take women who got pregnant, after they'd immerse and become tahor, they put them on that solid rock. That now you have an area, that solid rock, with a big gap underneath. So even if someone's buried underneath, on top of the rock, we know for sure there's no tumah. The women would stay there, give birth there, no one else would come, so they shouldn't be tameh then there, right? And then the children that were born, you could be 100% sure, never became tameh. We said, this is a far-out stringency. It doesn't exist anywhere else in Torah. The children would grow up on that rock. And when the time came to do the red heifer, they'd bring two cows, put a board on top of the cows, put the kids on the board. Again, what's the idea? In case they pass over a place that there's a dead body, well, then it doesn't shoot up because there's the board. There's the gap in between. Take these children to the stream. Then they draw the water with which we're going to sprinkle over there by the red heifer. Where do you find in Torah any such concept that I'm worried? Maybe somewhere there's a tumah? Doesn't exist. It's not a Torah concept. It's an extra stringency. One of the extra stringencies the rabbis made so that the people realize that the red heifer is very serious. Even though we're going to defile everyone that deals with it, you shouldn't take it lightly. They had a special bridge from the Beis HaMikdash to Har HaZeisim. Har HaZeisim is where they used to do the Parah Aduma because you had to look into the Beis HaMikdash and sprinkle towards the Beis HaMikdash.
So we know where, we can deduce where exactly they did the Parah Aduma.
Yeah.
We can figure it out.
Yeah, because it had to be from a location that he could look inside and see through the gates, see the Kodesh. The Gemara in Yuma even calculates the steps because that the Gemara calculates how high each entrance was. The Gemara ends up with a small gap that he could look through because Har HaBayis went up even inside the Temple Mount. Even inside the Temple, he kept going up and up and up steps. So the Gemara works out the math and says how high was this entrance and that entrance and the following entrance. So finally the Gemara says, okay, he had this gap of, I don't remember if it was a half an amma or an amma and a half, through which he could look and he'd look. And his gaze would go just above the top step and just beneath the entrance.
And from Har
HaZeitim,
it was so big, the entrance that you could see through.
Yeah.
That's not an easy, that's a pretty far.
But that also gives you a picture of where on Har HaZeitim they did the Parah Aduma. There aren't that many places. There aren't that many places on Har HaZeitim where you could actually look through with that entrance. We know how wide it is. So. Okay. You have to look at Har HaZeitim, and it has to be directly corresponding, like a direct line from there to the entrance.
So really
because from one of the sides, you wouldn't be able to see.
And that's on the other side of the Kotel, right? Because the Kotel was the back entrance. So
we're right.
Talking about the front entrance.
Right.
So that
right.
would be the other side. Like
correct. That would be the Kotel is the western side, the western wall. You're talking about the eastern wall, the eastern side.
What we don't see.
Right.
Oh no, would it be Dungate? No,
I don't
south. Know. That's south. So
you need the eastern,
other.
Right.
So it's right at the beginning there, probably. Right at the beginning of our...
I don't know how Har HaZeitim is built. I have no idea. I'm telling you how to figure it out. You figure it out. I don't know. I don't know the man.
This is where the people are buried, no?
Today, people are buried there, right.
But, this is a very, very holy place to be buried.
I guess, yeah.
I
don't know. I don't know. I think one of the reasons is because there's a medrash that says that Tchias HaMeisim is going to start there on Har HaZeisim. So I think that's why people wanted to be buried there.
Is that related to the Parah Aduma?
I don't know.
It's funny though, because we're just talking about in Paraduma, they want to make sure no one was buried in Harizatium, and now everyone's buried.
Right.
So it's a little ironic how they used to be so machmir that no one was buried there.
Well, it says the next Paraduma the Mashiach's going to do. It says there were 9 and the 10th one's waiting for Mashiach.
Right, so what's going to happen with that? They're going to have to find a spot in Harizatium that no one's buried.
I don't know. Maybe they'll make a platform. Remember, you could do it on a platform. Or they'll drill downwards and clear the space.
Can't you put a platform over Harizatium and then leave the space in between?
Yeah, they can go to the
same.
So if it was a glass platform, you could look down and see the grapes.
Right? Yeah, that's doable.
Glass
platform. Okay, so. The Kohen when they do the red cow, so they'd add a lot of wood because every ash that comes from that can be used. So you want as much ashes as you can because you only need a drop of ash with the water if you want to sprinkle and make someone pure. So might as well make as much ashes as you could. They'd store it in 3 locations. One was just outside the Beit HaMikdash in a place called Bechel. One was on Har HaZeisim, and that's where all of Israel who wanted to come up to be Oleh Regel or anyone who was defiled would get their sprinkle. And one was divided among the Kohanim. Each family had theirs, and that's the Kohanim used to purify themselves. So the Parah Aduma that Moshe made lasted throughout the period of the first temple. The next one that was made was in the beginning of the second temple. Ezra made it. And then another 7 were done on during the period of the second Beit HaMikdash. And the final one, as we said, is going to be done by the Mashiach.
Is there a reason why Moshe's lasted so long and the other one lasted so short?
Chazal tell us that there was a special bracha on everything Moshe did and everything David did, that it lasted. Special bracha on everything Moshe did. So there's a discussion about the purity of how Moshe did it and the purity of how David did it, that they didn't have foreign workers. That they didn't have foreign workers. Not only the Givonim, Shlomo built with foreign workers. And that's why Shlomo's did not last like David's. But whatever David did, so that lasted. And the Givonim, they were drawing water and chopping wood. They weren't building anything. Holy things have to be done by holy people, and that affects them. Being that we're close to being out of time, there are so many things to discuss in the parasha, I think we should move forward. There's a lot more to discuss about the Parah Aduma. You could listen to previous year's classes. We had a whole class explaining the procession, but for now, let's move forward. We have to understand this whole concept of Tumah. So what is Tumah? There are many different understandings, the Kuzari, the Rambam. We'll just touch one understanding. The Medrash says that when a person dies, so the angel of death comes, and the angel of death kills him with a sword. So the angel of death is, the epitome of defilement. And death really is a result of what happened with that serpent back in the Garden of Eden. And so death brings about defilement. Defilement is associated with death. On a simple level, the Torah gave us this mitzvah of defilement to ensure that we bury our relatives. Because otherwise, you know what you might do. Leave him hanging around, or take his bones and make your china out of them, or take his skin and make a carpet out of it, or do all kinds of weird things that people were doing.
Burn them up and put them on your
cabinet. Right.
That happens to them.
100%. 100%. So the Torah gave us a mitzvah that. The Torah gave us a mitzvah to bury the dead, and the Torah also wanted us to distance us from any use of the dead, rather to honor the dead, and the Torah told us to bury them. And this is such an important mitzvah that even the Kohen Gadol, if he encounters a corpse, even though if he touches it, if he deals with it, all of the service in the temple that he's supposed to do, all of that's going to be on pause for 7 days now. Nonetheless, the Torah said, deal with it. Part of the honor that God wants us to give the deceased is to ensure they get a proper burial. And if no one else is going to do it, then the Kohen Gadol has to do it. So we said there's this concept of defilement. How does that work? So if we have a corpse here, the corpse, let's say my cup of coffee is a corpse. Okay, so that's called Avi Avot Hatuma, father of all defilement. If a person touches it, he becomes an Avatuma. If that person touches a glass of water, so the water now becomes a Rishon Letuma. If you dip your tea biscuit in that water, the tea biscuit becomes a Sheni Letuma, a second level. Wait, wait, one step at a time. First, let's see the levels. So when it comes to Tumas Meis, the body is Avi Avosa Tuma, father of all Tumas. He who touches it becomes an Ava Tuma, and then he can make a Rishon Letuma. What about a vessel? So a vessel can also become an avatuma. How does a vessel become an avatuma? Either by touching it, or by being under the same canopy, the same covering as the dead body. Meaning, we say that tuma spreads upward and downward, and then if there's a ceiling, if there's any canopy over it, it spreads all under that canopy. So let's say I'm going to drive down the street, and there's a graveyard over there. But there's a beautiful tree, a great maple, that casts shade over the street and also over the graveyard. So then we say the tumah spreads under the tree. We said the tree forms a canopy, and the tumah shoots up until it hits that canopy, and then it spreads under the canopy. So anyone traveling under that canopy is going to become tameh. So far, so good? Any vessel, any person.
Closing the windows?
Closing the windows is not going to help. So what would help is a good question. We'll get to that in 1 second. Now, there's a difference between different vessels and how they become tameh. The Torah tells us that a metal vessel becomes tameh like the corpse itself. So a metal vessel, if you have a knife or a spoon or you have any metal vessel inside the tent with the dead body, that metal vessel now becomes an avi avot hatumah. You touch it, you become an avot hatumah, right? So a metal vessel becomes like the body. The sword or any other metal vessel becomes like the dead body. Wooden vessels are not like that. They just become tameh. Earthenware vessels are not like that. They just become tameh. What's unique about earthenware vessels? That earthenware vessels, the Torah says in our parsha, are mitameh me'aviro. They become defiled through their airspace. So if you have, let's say, you have an earthenware jug. Okay, here's my earthenware jug. You guys see it. Okay. Now I take an achbar, a dead mouse. Let's assume that one of the 8 creepy crawly creatures that are defiled when they die is the mouse. It says a choled v'achbar v'atzav le'mineu. So we don't know exactly what the achbar is, but let's say the achbar is a mouse. So I have a dead mouse. I take the mouse. Yeah. Okay, I take the mouse. I hang it in the airspace. I didn't touch anything. It says the Torah, the earthenware vessel became tameh. I put it down. I take a piece of popcorn. Yeah? I lick it, it's wet. Okay. I stick it into the airspace of the earthenware vessel. Now the popcorn is tameh. So the earthenware vessel receives tumah through its airspace and gives over tumah through its airspace. Now that gives us a certain leniency that the Torah tells us in our parsha. That let's say you have an earthenware jug, you have wine that's 300 years old. You want to ensure that that wine is going to stay good. You don't want it to become tameh, God forbid, right? You want to use it in the Beit HaMikdash. What do? You store it in an earthenware vessel, and you seal the earthenware vessel. The top has an earthenware top that's sealed. Now, no air enters its airspace, right? It's sealed. It's completely closed. So the Torah says that if you have an earthenware vessel that's sealed inside the defiled tent, even though there's a dead body there, and even if the body were to touch the earthenware vessel, remember what we say? We said earthenware only becomes defiled through its airspace. It doesn't become defiled by touch. So even if the earthenware vessel, the guy was about to pour himself a drink, he leaned over on put his hand on the earthenware vessel and had a massive heart attack, dropped dead. You walk into the room, you find him with his hand on the earthenware vessel. So what's the first thing you think? Hey, do I have to do CPR? You don't think about your earthenware vessel. But the second thing you think about is your 300-year-old wine. You say, wait a second, Jack, if you had to die, what'd you touch my earthenware vessel for, right? Okay, you don't say that. But at any rate, You say, thank God it was an earthenware, right? Because if it was an earthenware and the earthenware is sealed, so poor Jack who's dead, I can't help him. At least I could have the wine, right? Okay, so Jack, you know, by touching it, he didn't get it defiled because earthenware only gets defiled from the airspace. Even though it's in a tent, well, so what if it's under an overhang, under a ceiling? The earthenware is sealed shut. Good thing he didn't get his hands on it. You know, if he would have opened it, then we'd all lose our 300-year-old wine. Okay, so every dark cloud has its silver lining. So thank God the 300-year-old wine did not become defiled. So that's the another halacha that the Torah says in our parsha, that earthenware vessels that are completely sealed, well, then they don't become tamei, even if he touches it, because they only become tamei through the airspace. And even if they're inside the tent of a dead body. That's a kli cheres. Guys, you with me? So far, so good. Okay, fantastic. What?
That I got. No.
Okay, good. So, lot. Look, I'm going slower than I did previous years, but it's still a pretty fast pace with many new concepts. So whatever you get, you get. And whatever you don't get, either you listen again or you'll get next year. Okay. We have, if a person becomes tamei, so we sprinkle on him from the ashes. You sprinkle on the third day and on the seventh day. You put in pure spring water together with the ashes and you sprinkle. Only a drop has to go on him. And vessels can also become tahol by the same form of sprinkling. And only one drop has to go on him. You don't need a whole lot. So when they'd make the water, they'd want to get a lot of people together. Sometimes they'd line them all up, and then they'd spritz. And then everyone that got a spritz on them, okay, you're done, go home. They wanted to make the most of the water. Now there's a special halacha that anyone who moves the water of the para aduma becomes tamei. That's a special halacha. It's one of the things we don't understand. The Torah tells us Miriam passed away. Why did Miriam pass away? It doesn't say why Miriam passed away. The Torah tells us an interesting thing. It says that the whole congregation came to Midbar Tzin. We have a tradition that this pasuk, right here in our parsha, is telling you 40 years past. Meaning when the Torah tells you the whole congregation came, it's telling you everyone that was here was supposed to enter the land of Israel. There are three people that are going to die, right? Miriam, Moshe, and Aaron. But everyone else, that's it. We're dealing with the new generation in our parsha. So Miriam passes away. Maybe it was her time to die. 40 years passed, just like that. That's it. Now you move forward 40 years.
From the Meraglim to now.
To now. Now in our parsha, press fast forward, you're 40 years later. Right. New generation. How did the other generation pass away? Every Tisha B'Av, when it was the anniversary of their sin of the golden calf, they'd all dig graves, go lie down, and see, now this year, Tisha B'Av came, they lied down, and no one died. They said, hey, maybe we miscalculated. The next day, they all lie down in the graves, they all get up. They realized after a period that, hey, that's it, God's forgoing us this last year, no one's going to die this year. So that's it. Everyone's going to go into the land of Israel. So we're dealing with the new generation, which is slightly depressing because that means that all the sins we're going to learn about in our parsha, those are the sins of the new generation. It's a new slate, a new crowd. So Miriam passes away and she's buried and there's no water. And from here we learn out that all the years, 40 years we were traveling the desert, the reason why God gave us the water was in the merit of Miriam. So it's interesting. For 40 years, they're drinking water. Did anyone ever go over to Miriam and say, gee, thanks, Miriam. Thanks to you, we have water. Probably not. Because even we who learn the Torah have no way of knowing that it is in Miriam's merit that they had the water till Miriam dies. And I think that that's a phenomenal concept. That sometimes you have so much blessing from something, and you don't realize it till you lose it. When guys tell me they're thinking of leaving the yeshiva, I often tell them, might be a good idea, but one thing I'm going to guarantee you. Till you leave, you won't know what you're losing out by leaving. Because so long as you're here, and that's true for every place, so long as you have it, there are so many things you have that you don't even appreciate you're getting from the place. After you leave, you suddenly look back and say, gee, I never appreciated that I had three meals a day here. I went to yeshiva where they didn't give you supper at all. Nothing to complain about. You didn't get supper. Now work it out. They didn't have a washing machine in the yeshiva. Go figure it out now. No, not that you had to run after the madrich to buy coins. No washing machine. Your problem. Figure out where you're going to do your laundry. And so on and so forth. Simple things that you don't even appreciate till you lose them. And if that's true about a yeshiva, it's definitely all the more true about people. So when Miriam passes away, suddenly we run out of water. We will get water. In whose merit? In Moshe's merit. We had the clouds and the merit of Aaron. When Aaron passes away in our parsha, we lose the clouds, and that's why we're attacked. And again, the clouds come back and the merit of Moshe. So the nation starts fighting with Moshe. The nation says to Moshe, we wish we would have died like our brethren. We wish we would have died a more pleasant death. What's going on here? New generation. So who's complaining?
Serious depression.
Who's complaining? Ha-am. Who is ha-am? The nation? Not the Jewish people. They regret. Those that tagged along, which were big in numbers, but they were the tag-alongs. The people who never believed in it in the first place. They were tagging along. Ha'am.
They were rubbed in the
so nope. They had so I guess they had kids. So they start fighting with Moshe. And what'd you bring the whole congregation of God to die in this desert? This is the worst death in the world, to die of thirst. What'd you take us out of Egypt for? From? For? What?
How do we know what
they were from? Ha'am. Ha'am. The Medrash says, the Medrash points out that every time you have sins, it's Ha'am. You see it by the Egel. That, what does it say there? Eile Elokecha Yisrael. If they're the Jewish people, why are they saying this are your God Israel? They are Israel. No, they weren't Israel. They were the Erev Rav turning to Israel and saying, come, let's go back to worshipping the calf like we did in Egypt. So Moshe and Aaron come to the Ohel Moed and pray. And Hashem appears. And Hashem tells Moshe, take your staff, gather the congregation, you and Aaron, and talk to the rock. As they all witnessed, the rock will give forth its waters.
Sounds like a
Bodhisattva, doesn't it? So first question is, why take the staff if you're not supposed to use it? You're just going to talk to the rock. So for that, I refer you back, I think, to the first speech of the Ran, which we learned in this class. You can look, it's all in the titles on torahformeid.org. It titles each class what was discussed. So the Ran over there has a long piece explaining why Moshe was supposed to take the staff with him if he wasn't supposed to use it. And he discusses the concept that certain things that are used for miracles once contain a certain holiness, which make it that a miracle, so to speak, will more naturally occur in their presence. When you have holy things, so even things that are inanimate objects can carry a certain holiness with them. So God says, you'll talk to the Ra, and it will produce water, and then they will all drink and feed their cattle. You notice that God cares about the cattle. God doesn't disregard the cattle, and the idea is that God cares about our assets. God doesn't say, be spiritual, what do you care about your money for? No. God says, I'll give you water, and I'll give you water for your cattle too. Your assets are also important. So Moshe takes the staff, and you'll notice often in the Torah goes down to slow motion. You could have one pasuk fast forward 40 years, and then you suddenly have parshas in the Torah where the Torah suddenly zooms in. So Moshe took the staff, and Moshe and Aaron gathered the people by the rock, and Moshe said to them, listen here, you rebellious ones. What? Here they gathered all the Kahal. Now they gathered all of Am Yisrael. And that, according to some of the commentaries, was Moshe's sin. Because Moshe turns to the nation and says, listen here, you rebellious ones. What did they do? It was the Erev Rav. What's Moshe calling the people of Israel, you rebellious ones? What did they do? And according to some, that was his sin. Moshe says, is this the rock we should produce water from? And according to others, that was a sin. What do you mean we should produce water? You're not producing the water. God's producing the water. And Moshe lifts his hand and hits the rock. And water starts trickling out. And people start laughing. Ah, so you have 2 million people. We're all going to drink from that little trickle. So Moshe asks Aaron, what should we do? Should I hit it again? And Aaron says, yeah, hit it again. So he hits it again. And then a lot of water comes out and everyone drinks. And Hashem says to Moshe and Aaron, you guys didn't believe what I said. You didn't do the Kiddush Hashem you should have done. And that's why you're not leading them into the land of Israel.
That's why.
That's why. Why? What'd they do?
That's the punishment for this.
Right? What'd they do? What did Moshe and Aaron do wrong? So here we have many opinions among the commentaries. We'll begin with the final opinion. The Ramban says there's a deep, deep secret in what's going on here. When you learn Kabbalah, you'll understand. And I think we could live with that more than any other interpretation. Everything else is harder to swallow. What?
Water symbolizes Torah, and rock symbolizes...
the heart. Okay, so you guys know a lot of the Perushim. But maybe, if you want to, if we want to understand the story, maybe we have to begin with another story. There was once a great tribe that was taking a tremendous journey, and they were recording everything they were doing. And the king took his top advisor and prepared him for a long time to lead the people on this journey. And he said to him, look, this is the journey that's going to be recorded for centuries. I want you to be very careful what you do on this journey, because based on the laws that you enact in this journey, when you guys finally make it to New America or India or whatever country we'll call it, we're going to set down a set of laws, and those are going to be the norms. So you're going to lead the people, and I want you to be very careful as you lead the people, because I'm going to have a scribe with you, and we're going to write everything down. And whatever you enact there, that's going to be the law. So you have now 30 years to prepare. I'm telling you, in 30 years' time, you're going on the journey. So they go on the journey. And the whole time, they're writing down everything he says. You know, you guys have to be fair for one another. And when there are arguments and there are fights, every time the way he rules, that gets written down, and that's going to be precedent. And then, about a month before they reach their destination, people are getting anxious. And as people are getting anxious, they're getting on his nerves. And one day he's had it. He walks out there and he says, you guys are a bunch of idiots. I've been dealing with you for so long, and this is the way you behave. You guys are driving me crazy. You know, And the scribes are writing. And he's giving them this whole long speech, and the scribes are writing. And he says, what kind of nutniks are you? You know, by day, by night, whatever I do, you guys always have comments. And the scribes are writing. And how does it come across? When it comes time, at the end, they come and they're going to make a law, a legal system. At the end, when they hit the legal system, so they write down as the final note, and the leader has a right to call the guys all kinds of names, and when he's fed up with them, he could do this, and he could do that, and he could yell at them this, and yell at them that, and that becomes law. That's it. So that's the story of Moshe. No one was writing. But we have to understand that Moshe was not like me and you and anyone else. We have a halacha that says that there's a regular Talmud Chacham and then there's a super Talmud Chacham. What's a super Talmud Chacham? A super Talmud Chacham is someone who you could look at everything he does, record it, and learn from it. A regular Talmud Chacham can't live up to that level. In the times of the Mishnah, you had super Talmidei Chacham. In the times of the Gemara, you had super Talmidei Chacham. What does it mean to be a super Talmud Chacham? It means that I am so careful with everything I do that I don't only figure out what's right and wrong, I also figure out what's everyone who's looking at me going to think based on what I do. Rabbi Eliezer's neighbor had a cow that went out with a ribbon between her horns, and so everyone started publicizing, Rabbi Eliezer says it's okay to put such a ribbon on your cow on Shabbos. Did Rabbi Eliezer say it? Rabbi Eliezer didn't say it, but his neighbor put a ribbon on the cow's horns, so the Mishnah already says, well, Rabbi Eliezer held that. He didn't hold that. But Rabbi Eliezer was on a level that if his neighbor did it, and he didn't stop her, so then everyone said, well, obviously Rabbi Eliezer approves. Wow. That's a super Talmud Chacham. Huh? So if that's a super Talmud Chacham, where's Moshe Rabbeinu? He's way above that. Every cough, every sneeze was recorded in people's minds. I could tell you that I have a little bit of a tradition. And my Rebbe will sometimes quote to me the look of a rabbi when he answered a question, and that's part of the tradition I have. Not only what was said, but the look that was given when it was said.
The look was given?
A certain look, meaning the rabbi gave to the one who asked the question. Meaning that the tradition I have includes not only what was said, but the countenance of the person saying it. which is part of the tradition, as the Gemara tells us, as the Mishnah tells us. Part of the tradition is not only what was said, but how it was said. And I have traditions of reactions at a Shabbos table from the Bris Kerov when a certain thing happened, and his reaction is also teaches a certain halachos. So tradition, when we're talking about tradition and we're talking about bigger Talmidei Chachamim, it's everything they do has an impact on the way people perceive Torah. And when it's Moshe and the whole Torah revolves around him, so then we have to understand that there's much greater weight to what he does. So I see you guys are familiar with some of the pshatim, whether it was the fact that he got angry, whether it was the fact that he called them a name, Shimuna Amorim, whether it was the fact that he said, should we produce the water? Yeah, from our perspective, it's minuscule. But remember the mashal, and remember that in the times of the Gemara, people who were much, much less than Moshe Rabbeinu were held to such a high standard that everything they did, the assumption was, everyone's watching, you have to take that into account. So if that's the standard they were on, Moshe Rabbeinu, who's the beginning of the Torah, that Am Yisrael is really learning everything about Torah from him, when he, whose hallmark is ne'eman, trustworthy, when he does something that's not really a representation of God, it's his own fault. So he's not perfect. But his imperfection is now being interpreted by the people as something of God. So God's upset at us, but God wasn't upset at them. So he says, I will produce the water, but he's not producing the water. Whatever the sin was, and again, all these pshatim have their hardships. At the end of the day, I think they come back to this point. We have to appreciate the weight of Moshe Rabbeinu. And we'll continue maybe tomorrow night. We're out of